Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I've been displaced many times. It's not just once or twice, but at least five or six times. Almost as soon as we arrive somewhere, the Israeli military orders us to leave. I just arrived here to set up a tent 2 days ago, and now they're telling us to leave again.
Tens of thousands of already displaced Palestinians are forced to flee the southern city of Khan Yunis and Gaza after Israel orders yet another evacuation. This comes a day after over 100 Palestinians were killed in an Israeli airstrike on a school and mosque in one of the deadliest single attacks since October. We'll go to Gaza for the latest. Then inside Project 2025 secret training videos.
Allegedly, is everywhere. And if the American people elect a conservative president, his administration will have to eradicate climate change references from absolutely everywhere.
ProPublica publishes videos created for Project 2025 that feature many former Trump officials laying out a far-right policy agenda if he's reelected. We'll speak with the reporter who broke the story. And the Summer Olympics hold its closing ceremony in Paris. We'll look at France banning its Olympians from wearing the hijab and Algerian boxer Iman Khalif being subject to false claims of being male or transgender. And French authorities systematically displacing unhoused people in Paris. And as the Paralympics is set to start later this month, we'll speak with a Palestinian Paralympian from Gaza. He's been disabled since he was shot by an Israeli soldier in Gaza City in 2001. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Officials in Gaza say more than 100 people were killed Saturday in an Israeli attack on a school and mosque where thousands of displaced Palestinians had sought shelter. The attack on the El Tabin school in Gaza City was one of the deadliest individual attacks since Israel's war on Gaza began over 10 months ago. Rescue workers said they did not find a single full body among the dead. Just body parts often destroyed beyond recognition. Survivors said Israel attacked the school during morning prayers.
It's a mosque inside a school. People were praying the dawn prayer. They struck three missiles and one didn't explode. It's on the rooftop. Remains of people, children and women, the elderly were here. What did they do? Look, these are remains everywhere. They are from the displaced people who fled to here. Without a warning or anything, what can I say? I'm speechless. More than 100 were killed. There are still bodies under the rubble even now. Children are missing and some were injured. What can I say?
Israel claimed Hamas was using the school as a command center. CNN's confirmed a U.S.-made GBU-39 small-diameter bomb was used in the Israeli strike on the school. The attack came just 2 days after the Biden administration notified Congress it's preparing to provide Israel with an additional $3.5 billion to spend on U.S. weapons and military equipment. Congress had approved the money as part of a $14 billion package for Israel in April. Zetaya reports part of the new U.S. package includes a direct sale of 6,500 Joint Direct Action munitions to Israel. In related news, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has ordered a guided missile submarine to head to the Middle East and for a strike group of fighter jets and Navy warships to sail more quickly to the region as Israel's bracing for possible retaliatory strikes from Iran and Hezbollah after Israel assassinated Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran and a top Hezbollah commander in Beirut. On Friday, Israel continued its assassination campaign by killing a Hamas commander in the Lebanese city of Sidon. Meanwhile, the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt have called on Israel and Hamas to resume ceasefire talks on Thursday in Cairo. Hamas responded by saying it supports the ceasefire proposal put forward by President Biden rather than any new plan. Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris and her running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, spoke before a crowd of over 15,000 in Arizona Friday in their largest rally to date. During Harris's speech, a group of protesters began chanting, "Free, free Palestine." The vice president paused to respond.
And let me just say this on topic of what I think I'm hearing over there. Let me just speak to that for a moment, and then I'm going to get back to the business at hand. Say, I have been clear. Now is the time to get a ceasefire deal and get the hostage deal done.
Harris's response to the pro-Palestinian protesters in Arizona marked a notable shift in tone from how she reacted to protesters in Michigan.
If you want Donald Trump to win, then say that. Otherwise, I'm speaking.
In other campaign news, Donald Trump has falsely accused Kamala Harris of using artificial intelligence to fabricate photos showing large crowds at her rallies. Last week, Harris spoke in front of 15,000 supporters at an airport hangar in Detroit, but Trump falsely claimed the massive crowd didn't actually exist despite extensive photographic and video evidence. Trump wrote, quote, "There was nobody at the plane," and that the massive crowd, quote, "didn't exist." This comes as numerous reports emerge that Trump has been shocked by the early strength of Harris's campaign, as new polls shows her leading in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. The New York Times reports the former president has repeatedly called Harris a bitch in private. Russia's ordered residents in parts of the Belgorod region to evacuate as Ukraine expands its attacks inside Russian territory. Thousands of Ukrainian troops are now pushing into both the Kursk and Belgorod regions of Russia in a surprise offensive that began 6 days ago. Meanwhile, a Russian missile hit a supermarket in eastern Ukraine Friday, killing at least 14 people, injuring 43 others. In other news from the region, Ukraine and Russia are blaming each other after a major fire broke out Sunday at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, which has been occupied by Russian forces for 2 years. Russia accused Ukraine of shelling the plant, while Ukraine blamed Russia for starting the fire, which occurred in the plant's cooling towers. In Bangladesh, interim leader Muhammad Yunus has appealed for unity amidst ongoing turmoil and religious tensions as Bangladesh transitions to a new government after the student-led ouster of longtime Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina. Yunus, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, met with and embraced the weeping mother of Abu Sayyid, the first student to have been killed in the unrest last month. On Saturday, Bangladesh's Chief Justice and Central Bank Governor resigned as protesters encircled the Supreme Court. Students are now focused on unseating officials they say abetted Sheikh Hasina's repressive rule. She's fled to India. The Biden administration's decided to resume sending offensive arms to Saudi Arabia, lifting a ban that had been in place since 2021. The U.S. had halted offensive arms sales 3 years ago amidst public outcry over Saudi Arabia's role in the devastating war in Yemen. U.S.-led peace talks between warring parties in Sudan are set to proceed in Geneva this week, even as Sudanese officials say they have not yet agreed to send a delegation. Sudan says the U.S. failed to ensure the paramilitary rapid support forces, or RSF, first commit to respecting an existing agreement, the Jeddah Declaration. Sudan also objects to including the United Arab Emirates as an observer in the negotiations, as they accuse the UAE of supporting the RSF. This comes amidst a spiraling humanitarian disaster in Sudan, where the UN's declared famine in a North Darfur camp and ongoing heavy flooding has led to even more displacement and deaths. In the Philippines, the independent news website Rappler has won an eight-year-long legal battle and will continue its operations after a court voided a shutdown order issued under former President Rodrigo Duterte. Rappler and its Nobel Peace Prize-winning co-founder, Maria Ressa, were consistently persecuted by Duterte for their critical coverage of his authoritarian rule and his deadly war on drugs. Maria Ressa spoke after the court ruling.
This court decision, the latest in a string of court victories for Rappler, is a much-needed reminder that the mission of journalism can thrive, even in the line of fire, to speak truth to power, to hold the line, to build a better world.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting the Biden administration has been pushing to arrange for Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to leave office in exchange for amnesty for him and other top Venezuelan officials. The report comes 2 weeks after Venezuela held a contested election where both Maduro and the opposition have claimed victory. Peru has passed a bill that bars the prosecution of crimes against humanity committed before 2002. If signed into law by President Dina Boluarte, it could benefit convicted former President Alberto Fujimori and hundreds of others who carried out crimes during Peru's internal conflict from 1980 to 2000. The UN slammed the legislation, saying it, quote, risks endangering the rights to truth, justice, reparations, and guarantees of non-recurrence for thousands of victims of grave violations in Peru. In Brazil, authorities are investigating after a plane crash in Sao Paulo killed all 62 people on board. Among the dead were eight doctors who were headed to an oncology conference. Another victim was a lawyer who represented clients in cases against airlines. And a federal appeals court extended a block on the Biden administration's student debt relief plan known as SAVE, which lowers monthly payments for millions and accelerates debt cancellation for some borrowers who had taken out smaller loans. Before it was put on hold, the SAVE program had already canceled $5.5 billion for over 400,000 borrowers. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli attacks in Gaza have killed 142 Palestinians in the last 48 hours, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. The official death toll now stands at just under 40,000, with over 92,000 people injured. However, the true number of dead is likely far higher, with many thousands of dead unaccounted for. Figures from the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics show Israeli forces have killed 1.8% of the Gaza Strip's population since October, with 75% of the victims under the age of 30. Among the deadliest single attacks in Gaza came early on Saturday morning when Israel bombed the Al-Tabayin school in Gaza City, where thousands of Palestinians sought shelter. Officials in Gaza say over 100 Palestinians were killed in the attack, many of them while they were praying at a mosque inside the school. Most of the dead were dismembered or disfigured beyond recognition. According to Manda Weiss, doctors have collected body parts and are handing over plastic bags filled with 70 kilos of human remains to family members of those killed whose bodies cannot be identified. Meanwhile, CNN has confirmed a U.S.-made GBU-39 small-diameter bomb was used in the strike. It was the latest attack in what the United Nations Human Rights Office called the, quote, systematic attacks on schools, unquote, with at least 21 Israeli strikes on schools, each serving as a shelter since July 4th alone. The deadly bombing of the Al-Tabayin school also came 2 days after the Biden administration notified Congress it's preparing to provide Israel with an additional $3.5 billion to spend on U.S. weapons and military equipment. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of Palestinians have been forced to flee the southern city of Khan Yunis and sleep on sidewalks and streets after the Israeli military ordered more evacuation orders in the city early Sunday, including in part of a previously designated so-called humanitarian zone. The latest order follows similar directives issued by the Israeli military in the eastern regions of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza and other parts of Khan Yunis Thursday. The vast majority of Gaza's population of 2.3 million people have been displaced, often multiple times. Khan Yunis had already suffered widespread destruction during an Israeli air and ground offensive earlier this year. For more, we go to Gaza, where we're joined by Palestinian journalist Shirouk Ela. She runs Ayin Media in Gaza and joins us today from outside the Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah. Shirouk, thank you for joining us. Can you talk about the strike on the Israeli school and mosque on Saturday? How significant this was with the killing of about 100 people.
Hey, I'm devastating to talk about such topic that happened on Saturday, that we woke up in a very heartbreaking news of targeting a school, which is a shelter for almost 600 displaced people from the Gaza City and the northern part of the Gaza City as well. And those people who sought shelter at this school, believing that the schools are safe areas, which is absolutely not. And this attack, the Israeli war plan attacked the school with the three rockets left it behind over 100 pieces of people. I'm seeing pieces because nobody were able to recognize the full body of their beloved ones. Like, they scattered in pieces, and also, it's not also about the 100 who got killed in a cold blood as well. There are also thousands who left severely injured. Like, among those injuries, there are lots of amputations as well. Let me say, the attack happened during the Al-Fajr prayer, which is a dawn prayer, like, that is almost at 5 a.m. And after this prayer, most of the people, the displaced people, decided to stay at the mosque to recite Quran, and the massacre happened.
Now, can you respond to what Israel is saying, that it was some kind of Hamas headquarters, yet Euromed Human Rights Monitor said Sunday a list provided by the Israeli army of alleged targets at the school include individuals who were killed in previous attacks and civilians who opposed Hamas?
Look, like each severe attack, we used to hear that same narrative from the Israeli side, that this massive attack that left it lots of injuries and casualties, there is always something that is saying that Hamas is behind all of these. But basically, when it comes to the footage, and when you look deeper at the losses and the names, you see just innocent people, mostly kids and women as well. So let me say, it's just normal. We are getting used to such speech from the Israeli side, that wherever attacks happen, there is that excuse that there is Hamas beyond this. But you know that Gaza is full of, like, is overcrowded with people. Like, it's almost like 200 and a half population, and for sure those people, they are innocent. They are holding home. They are holding hopes, like, to live in peace, and nobody wished for a war, you know? And if you are switching for the southern part of the Gaza Strip, in the past 2 weeks, the Israeli army issued multiple evacuation orders for the Rafah area, Khan Yunis area, Deir al-Balah area, and also Nusayrat, and also even though the north, like, lots of evacuation orders, like, every day that happens. Like, you imagine, like, you are suffering to find a spot to set up your makeshift tent and find the access for water, for bathrooms, and for essentials. And then eventually it ends up with immediate orders of evacuation. And the only thing that you can do at such moment is just to flee and run for your safety, along with your family members, leaving behind the essentials that painstakingly you gathered with time and money.
There are
people that I know that have been displaced so far plus 15 times.
Can you respond to the latest news of the possibility of ceasefire talks being renewed? Hamas said they want to abide by the Biden proposal, ceasefire proposal, in May. Are talks, what is your understanding of, are talks going to resume, and the response of people on the ground in Gaza where you are?
Let me say, each time we hear the ceasefire talks, Each time we hold that hope that it will work out eventually, like even though it's never happening on the ground, but you know, we are people here are tiring and tired to that level that they are stuck with every tiny sense of hope that it will end very soon. And after pointing the replacement for Hamas leader Sinwar, despite that people are with or against this option, still they are hoping that this change will bring and pay back the results of having a ceasefire on the ground.
I also want to ask you about the killing of Palestinian journalists. It pains me to do this as you stand there with your press flak vest with the clear words press on it. Israel bombed the home of the Palestine TV journalist Tamim Ma'amar in Khan Yunis on Friday, killing him along with his wife and two of their children. A separate airstrike on the home of Al-Aqsa TV journalist Abdullah Al-Susi killed him and two of his nephews. This follows the killing of Al Jazeera Arabic journalist Ismail Al-Ghul and his cameraman Rami Al-Rifi on July 31st. Your husband, the journalist Rushdie Siraj, was killed in an Israeli airstrike in October. You've taken over the leadership of AIN Media from him. Talk about the latest killing of journalists in Gaza. The number now at this point, well over 100 journalists killed.
According to the Ministry of Health, like almost 100 plus 160 journalists got killed. Most of them, they were directly attacked by the Israeli army. And frankly, I'm saying this in a very obvious word that I prefer, whenever I go for filming and coverage, I prefer not to wear the press vest because I started to believe that this press vest is a threat and we are targeting because of it. It's never protecting us. It's not only me. It's the same feelings that we all journalists are sharing with it, that we're tired of being followed and being threatened and being attacked. And what we are doing is just screening all the massacres on the screen, like in front of the media, like. And somehow I feel we are in need for the access of foreigner journalists to come in and join us during the coverage. Maybe they have some words that left that we did not say so far, and it's good to hear the reality from other mouths, you know, because like everything has been featured on the screen. We have been slaughtered in the screen like since almost plus 10 months so far, and nothing's happening on the ground. It's just all about following and attacking more and more journalists. And I can say that it puts more pressure on us, especially when it comes to your family and your friends and even the people outside in the streets. They are somehow feeling that we are a threat and afraid of walking by, like, because we are holding a camera or wearing a breast vest. And it's never a secure feeling that we should feel, especially at just timing of genocide. I think there is a need to make more pressure in the media to have access for foreigner journalists to come in and do more coverage and help us in spreading the word.
Shiruk Ela, I want to thank you for being with us, independent journalist and producer in Gaza. Again, her husband, Rushdie Siraj, was killed in Israeli airstrike in October. She now runs his media outlet, AIN Media. Coming up, Inside Project 2025 secret training videos. Stay with us. Bach's Prelude to Suite 5, performed by Yo-Yo Ma. In New York City, professional cellist John Mark Rosendahl is facing up to 7 years for playing a piece from Bach's Suite for Cello outside the headquarters of Citibank during a climate protest. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. It's War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at the far-right policy plan to overhaul the federal government, known as Project 2025. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump's trying to downplay his connection to the plan. And last week, Kevin Roberts, head of the influential right-wing Heritage Foundation, postponed the release of his Project 2025 book until after the November election. The book's foreword is written by Trump's vice presidential running mate, J.D. Vance. Trump's campaign insists it has no connection to the right-wing blueprint for immigration, almost 1,000 pages long, a blueprint for immigration, reproductive rights, climate policy, and more. But many of the key figures working for Project 2025 are former top Trump administration officials. Some of them featured in newly released videos that were created for Project 2025's Presidential Administration Academy. In a major new development, the independent news outlets ProPublica and Documented have now published dozens of these videos, some of which will feature today. In this clip, Trump's former deputy chief of staff at USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, Bethany Kozma, discusses climate change.
Climate change, allegedly, is everywhere. And if the American people elect a conservative president, his administration will have to eradicate climate change references from absolutely everywhere. And according to our intelligence community, the number one threat facing our country today is, drumroll, climate change. Not Russia, not China, not AI, climate change. This shows how the federal government is all in on this issue. And climate change activists wield a lot of power. This is an issue to pay attention to as it has infiltrated every part of the federal government. Now, when I think of climate change, I immediately think of population control, don't you? I think about the people who don't want you to have children because of the impact on the environment. Perhaps not everyone will make that connection, but after spending time in the international space trying to protect life, I can tell you that this is part of their ultimate goal. To control people.
That's conservative activist and former Trump official Bethany Kozma in a newly released Project 2025 training video. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Andy Kroll, investigative reporter for ProPublica, whose new expose is headlined Inside Project 2025 Secret Training Videos. ProPublica has posted the full 23 videos, totaling more than 14 hours of content on its website. Andy, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain how you got the videos and their significance as we go through some of them.
Yeah, the videos come from the Presidential Administration Academy, which is one of the main pillars of Project 2025. We've heard a lot about, you've talked about on this show, the extreme policy proposals that Project 2025 put out in its 900-page mandate for leadership document. What's gotten less attention, but is no less important to Project 2025's long-term goal here, is to train thousands of future political appointees so that if a conservative president, which of course now means if Donald Trump, a conservative candidate, wins in November and we have a Republican president, that there will be a bench of thousands of vetted and trained appointees who can go into the government and fill openings in that government so that, as Project 2025 itself says on its website, that conservative administration can be ready from quote unquote day one. Now, these videos were provided to us by a source who had access to them. I won't get into the sourcing on it, but with any kind of situation like this, the key things for us at ProPublica are these videos real? Are they authentic? And are they newsworthy? Obviously, the substance is newsworthy. In our reporting process, we talk to people who are in the videos. We verified them, authenticated them, and fact checked them ourselves. And now we've published on them. And as you helpfully pointed out, also published all of these 23 videos totaling more than 14 hours on our website. Anyone watching today can go and watch them now.
Andy, if you can just give us some background again on Project 2025.